STL or studio to transmitter section, which is what gets your signal from your studio to your transmitter site, assuming that your transmitter is not incorporated in your studio location. And what we're going to talk about here is the possible unlicensed STLs. There are licensed ones that really are outside the what we can talk about here. A licensed one takes an engineer to put it all together for an application, and it's the equipment's a lot more expensive.
That's coming a little bit later.
So what we're going to talk about is we have three different possible ways of doing it with relatively inexpensive equipment that's been on the market here for 3 or 4 years. The one that the manufacturer that we lean on fairly heavy is Ubiquiti because it's fairly inexpensive. You can do a 5.8 gigahertz STL for what? The equipment, maybe $300 or something like that. I say here it's got a range of maybe 4 or 5 miles or longer, depending on the interference conditions in the area. If you're around a big city, you're probably going to have some interference to deal with. If you're out in the country, it's probably a lot less likely. The 5.8 gig is line of sight. Okay, from your antenna on your studio to the receive antenna at your transmitter site, you got to be able to see it from the top of the tower. And you really can't have any vegetation or buildings or something like that in the middle. There's also 2.4 gigahertz, which in most areas you'll find is very congested. You can find somebody with a spectrum scope and take a look at it and try to see what's there, but I'd recommend starting with the 5.8. The other choice is a 900 megahertz. These are all in the ISM band, which was originally supposed to be for what is it, industrial, scientific, and medical use. But the FCC is kind of backed off on that, and they're letting everybody use it now. That's what ISM stands for, anyhow. 900 megahertz for about maybe a little more than 300, maybe $400, you can get both ends of it. And it's got some tolerance to things in the middle of your path. It doesn't necessarily have to be completely line of sight. It will penetrate some light vegetation. Some small buildings maybe that might be in the line of sight path. The density of the vegetation will determine how far you can get with it. If you got a relatively short distance and a line of trees that isn't too thick, you might be able to go anywhere from less than a mile to 4 or 5 miles. You really got to judge what's in the middle of the path and take a guess at it and try it out. But for $300 or $400, it's worth compared to a licensed one. I mean, it's worth giving it a try. For that amount of money. Now, all three of these options takes an IP codec, right? Because this is digitized now. It's not analog any longer. So, and the one that we use quite extensively is made by Barix, B-A-R-I-X. And there's a couple of different models of that. You can also use the same IP codecs to put it on the internet and use the internet for an STL if you want to try to do that. And there's a lot of ifs, ands, and buts to that.
Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
And you need to understand the transmission path of how it gets from one to the other. If you cross between different ISPs, Internet Service Providers, there's a thing called a gateway between them, right? You want to try to stay away from that if you can. A mom-and-pop STL or ISP provider are usually a lot easier to work with than the nationals like AT&T and Verizon.
And can you say why that is? That the mom and pops, then you can just get a person to talk to you. Is that why they're?
That's a big part of it, and they're local usually, right? The smaller ones, and will work with you an awful lot easier. Now, the one fly in the ointment for doing it this way over the internet is that net neutrality is kind of hanging in the balance right now. And I would encourage you all to come to the presentation after this one between 5 and 6:30 on net neutrality, which will just, you know, follow the LPFM series and learn something about that.
Actually, it interferes with this session. Yeah. We have a segment here at 5 and 6:30. So if they go to the net neutrality, they have to miss the last section of this.
Yeah, that's true.
So just to add a little bit of more flies to that ointment, even if net neutrality wasn't an issue in regards to using the internet as your STL, it does create a situation where you need to have an ISP related connection on the receiving end, on the transmitter side. And so that will incur more costs possibly, and also, you know, like a whole other array of like issues regarding utility and access, especially if all you were counting on was just having electricity at the transmitter site. Yeah. So the nice thing about like a typical or the using an IP codec is that that's your own Wi-Fi link, and you're not actually having to pay for internet access. You're just creating that as if you had like a can with a long wire attached to it, so it kind of puts you more in control of the of that option.
And don't be afraid to go with more than one hop. We recently did a two hop in Puerto Rico, and it worked flawless.
But that was not internet, though. So.
That's true. No, this was our own microwave.
This was at 5.8.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Does anybody ever do their web stream as the link? Does that work?
Well, that's basically what he was saying regarding using the ISP. That's effectively what that
works. I set them up that way.
Yeah, were you just taking a webcast that you already have and just picking it up?
One variant of that is that the answer to can it be done hasn't been done yet. But in terms of do you want to do that? Well, if you must. But it actually works better to have a more direct link.
Well, one thing we've noticed with that webcast thing is you get delay.
There is late, delay, yeah. Sometimes the delay you just have to accept that you're going to get a delay.
The delay is inherent in any kind of IP system.
Even the STL system, there's delay?
Much less so, but yes.
If you're going to the public internet,
If you're using the internet, or, you always, when you're digitizing something, you're always doing a bunch more things to it. You're taking it all, the audio, and you're breaking it into ones and zeros, and then you're sending it, and then you're retransforming it. So there's like a small delay there. And also the internet by its nature, it's great at sending a lot of stuff, but it's not great at sending at every microsecond, right? So a
burst
squirrel
speed.
Runs up and down like your line, and it'll cross the wires for a second, and then it moves on and it's fine again, but then you just lost a second of, you know, a signal. So what almost everything uses is a buffer, And so, you know, and that's what YouTube's doing when it starts out, is it's getting a little bit to start out and getting a little ahead, and then it's making up for all the packets that are coming along. So any kind of digitization, you're going to have at least some delay from live.
If you're going to try to do your STL on the internet, you will get the best quality out of it if your ISP, you have the same ISP on both ends, right? And then even to add to that, if you have a local ISP, a mom and pop, you'll get the best out of it, and they'll pay the most attention to you. If you go with Verizon or AT&T, you're not going to get any special accommodations out of them at all.
So if you don't have line of sight, internet is the best option.
I think if you can make it in a two-hop of your own microwave, I'd go that route rather than I'd avoid public internet if at all possible.
Okay.
But the 900 will, in some cases, if you have minimal obstructions in the midst, between your studio and your transmitter site, the 900 version that's up there on this thing may be able to get through it, okay, with some somewhat obstructed line of sight.
Like trees, for example?
Yeah, trees or smaller buildings in the middle of the path.
How far away can a studio be from the tower, from that antenna?
Well, there's an FCC limitations on that, on how far they can. Do you know what those are right off?
Nothing about right.
Well, your studio had to be
10 miles.
Within 10 miles? As a practical matter, you're usually going to be within a few miles of your transmitter site with any LPFM.
But people make these IP links work for really far.
Yeah.
The record is like 90 miles. You wouldn't want to rely on that for audio, but you know, people regularly do them 10 miles, 20 miles, you know, with better equipment.
Regarding the ISP, though, like for instance, Warehouse 21 is using Comcast. And they're suggesting we just upgrade to Comcast Business Class, but I would much rather use a local provider like, you know, Cyber Mesa or CNSP. And what would you advise? Because they already have Comcast set up. They want to upgrade to Business Class at $199.95 a month, but I'd much rather support local.
Yeah.
Would that be a better recommendation?
And so you have to get fast at both ends.
So you have to
evaluate your situation.
Exactly.
Locally.
So, like, your transmitter site has internet access.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's far enough away from your studio site that you'd want to use the internet.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean,
I only ask that just because, like, a lot of places, you know, that people are setting up their transmitters, there's no phone line, there's no, you know, or cable, you know, like Comcast or what have you, or even the mom and pop. So that wouldn't be feasible anyway, right? So then you'd want to like figure out how to do these, which I think are better option typically is like these other, you know, like doing the direct link connections.
One thing about web stream, which is actually in many ways the same as web stream when you try to put, is you might want to have a web stream that only you know about. Runs it in a higher quality mode. Because a lot of times when you're doing the web stream for public consumption, you might run it at, let's say, a 96K MP3, which is kind of so-so in quality. And if you're doing, you're using it as your STL, you might want to have a better quality stream that is used just for that. And maybe, combination one would be a higher bit rate. Twice, three times the bit rate, or another possibility is to run a different format like on-orbis for better quality.
Yeah.
Well, you can get rid of the delay if you go to a licensed STL.
Yeah.
Okay. That will get rid of it if you go analog. There's very high priced digital ones around that don't have much delay at all. But that's really out of the price-wise, these things are pretty much out of the reach of LPFM, out of most of them. And you got to go through the licensing procedure. You need an engineer to do that. And it takes a while to get the license back for it.
But they are the most reliable. So.
Yeah. Correct.
I have a question. So we have way, way, way more trees than people. And we are going to do an STL, like short distance, quarter mile, something like that. And it seems like the 924, 928 megahertz, because it can get through some vegetation. I mean, how often are we going to be needing to get a friend to do some tree climbing and limb some tree?
If you've got access to the trees,
yeah.
You know,
well,
that's
how close
at that distance? At that distance, you're not going to have a problem.
Well, how close to the the vegetation that's very close to one end or the other has much more of an effect in the middle, because the signal actually spreads out in a virtual football called the Fresnel zone in three dimensions. So you can have obstructions in parts of that football and the rest of it will get through.
Okay.
If the tree's right in front of your ditch, you've got a problem. If it's
the trees are
a half a mile down the road or even two blocks down the road, it's probably not a problem at all.
The trees are in the middle. We can then cut down trees.
Then actually 5.8 for a short hop like that probably works.
So 5.8, is the technology the same cost? I'm just thinking that the 928.
This gear is very cheap.
Right.
Compared for $400, either 900, 5.8, or 2.4, you can try it, right? And if you've got a few trees, I'd say spend the $400 and try it out and see what it does for you.
Okay. If it doesn't work for you, you could always put it on Craigslist to the rest of the LPFM somewhere.
Okay, we'll try it next.
I actually never recommend internet. I might be stuck in 2005 or something like that, but I've just had too many nightmare experiences, like with buffering and like things coming off. And, if you can do your own for like $400 or $500 worth of equipment, or even if you have to do a second hop, I just always go that way.
I'm just comparing the two, 5.8 versus 5.8.
Yeah, if you got trees in the middle, spend the $400 and try it out. If it's only a quarter mile long, you'll probably get through it.
Is this clear for folks, the distinction that's being made here? Just want to ask, because I know it can be kind of like, they're both using IP, it's both like audio to digital, and stuff, but one's via the internet, right? And the other's just like a Wi-Fi link.
Let me say something about the two codecs that we have on here. Relatively inexpensive. For about $600 or a little more, you can get two of the Barax units, one for each end. And the good thing about those is that you can run your transmitter controls over it too in a couple of different ways. And it's two-way communication. You don't use the stuff coming back. You use it for the acknowledgement on your control, which works real good. The $600 pair is unbalanced data going into it. So you may have to make a conversion coming out of your studio from balanced to unbalanced. If you go up to the 500 model, it takes two of them, and those are XLR balanced audio in and out, and that's the most that's the one. If you can spend the money, that's what you ought to shoot for, because then you don't need additional impedance converters and stuff to take it down to unbalanced.
If you use the STL ones, the first ones we were talking about, those don't do transmitter control, is what we're saying, right?
No, when you use the IP codecs, okay, that will transmit the transmitter controls.
But these other ones won't.
Which other ones?
The 5.8, the 2.4.
No, that what you do, you add the IP codecs to each end of the 5.8, the 2.4, or the 900. Okay, they,
to get the control.
Yes, that will give you the ability to transmit the control back and forth.
It's just a long length of Cat 5 wire. Just think of the microwave links are a long length of wire. And the codecs are one of the devices you can put into that little network hub at each end. But you can have your transmitter and your laptop and any number of other things too.
IP codecs with the other gear, not as a standalone.
Correct.
You need both. The IP codecs just makes IP to audio and audio to IP. But you still have the IP you can do other things with, like transmitter control.
And then just with the codecs themselves, you can set those up to go over the internet instead of the microwave if you wanted to go that way.
I'm just going to draw a picture while you guys do it, just to make sure.
Thank you.
Yeah. We'll draw it on the easel or something.
Yeah. We have pictures of course.
You have to use those. Otherwise, you have no way of digitizing your audio, assuming that it comes out of your studio as analog.
Oh, okay. So all this is doing is once you digitize it, it's getting it there, and then you still have to undigitize it at the other
right.
end.
Right, and the codec does that on each end, right? It digitizes it, then it, on the transmitter end, it brings it back down to analog again.
And that will also allow you to control the transmitter through that same link.
Correct. It'll go. You'll split it off from the IP portion of it. Okay, with a probably a switch would do that really well.
I'm just looking for
what's
your drawing.
What's the function of the XLR in this thing, and how does that provide superiority in your mind?
Well, then you have balanced audio as against unbalanced audio.
Coming in analog, getting digitized, getting undigitized, going out.
Right. The analog can be balanced or unbalanced.
Okay.
Unbalanced is like an RCA jack that you plug into your consumer gear.
It also will give you bi-directional audio. You can bring audio back from the transmitter if you want to get some.
And in fact, that's going to happen in the one we put together in Vieques, because the transmitter site is on a separate island from the studio, and they're going to build a studio on the island underneath the transmitter, and then they can take that audio and pipe it back to the main studio where they can edit it or do whatever they want with it.
All right, I'm running out of colors here, but all right, so just because we're throwing around a lot of words, and probably most of them are kind of crappy words that only engineers use, talking about your mixer, that's where like all your sound goes into, microphone, CD player, that kind of thing. Then in order to get that, the easy way to do this is to have the mixer in the same place as and your studio in the same place as your transmitter. In which case, you don't need any of this stuff. You just take the sound out of this, you put it into your transmitter, and it goes out to the world for people to listen. But that's usually not practical because most people don't like to go up to places where there are transmitters because they're as high as possible. So usually you need a studio transmitter link to go from one part to the other. So when you do that, there's two kinds of boxes we're talking about. One is one box with a little antenna, and that is licensed. It costs about $10,000, and you send the signal from one place to the other. Wave two, so that's wave one, and that's what everyone did until 10 years ago. Wave two is you can take that and put it into what's called a codec or an encoder. And that could be your computer with a piece of software on it, or it could be these little Varex boxes. And those Varex boxes cost about $600 for a pair, and it changes the audio, which is like into 0111000110, and you can send that audio in, and then you get that over to the other codec,
and you put in the 110000 and out comes beep, 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 you know, and it goes into the transmitter, turns into sound, and turns into radio. Goes out to
the We're going to show some pictures of STL and the rack at the transmitter.
Yeah. So now it gets just a little, the plot thickens, like you see it just a little further, in that there are two ways you can send those ones and zeros. One is over the internet, in which case you call Comcast and you get an account and you get one at both ends.
You get two accounts.
And that sends one. But it's only as reliable as the internet, which, you know, who has 100% reliable internet?
You get
two. All right, so there are reasons to do it because you probably already have it, but there's also, you know, it's only going to be as good as your internet. Way two is to buy a second set. So besides the codec, you know, which costs about $600 for the pair, there is also, you get this pair of dishes that acts like, it acts sort of the same way as the internet, but it doesn't go through the internet. It's just like the Ethernet cable that connects, that used to connect your computer to your cable box.
It's glorifying Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And it's a transmitter inside an antenna.
Yeah.
All one piece.
So this doodad, which usually either Microtech or Ubiquiti, they cost about like $300, $400 a piece for a pair of them. And if you have line of sight, you can send your ones and zeros this way instead of by way of the internet.
You can get both of them for $300 at 5.8.
Depending on the distance, you know, and like you can get really expensive ones that can go 20 miles or whatever, you know, real cheap ones you can get for about $150 or $200.
The cheapest ones are actually the $89 a piece.
Yeah.
So they work, but we don't recommend
it. So like you're saying, two hops, for example, would you add four?
You need to do two hops. Let's say there's a big mountain in the way, then it won't work, right? So what you do is you go up on top of that mountain, you buy two more of them, and you put one here and one there, and the Ethernet cable between, and then your radio, your zero and one radio stream goes like that, and then down like that.
Actually, that's what we have up on the screen up there right now. It's in a lot of detail. It shows all the different pieces of equipment.
I can explain it all if you want.
Any questions on this level of that?
No, that one's easier to understand.
It's just that they're like, you know, we use lots of words interchangeably. Like, I think we use digital in two or three different ways, you know, during anything.
But usually, to be clearer, if it's IP, we say IP. If it's digital, we're usually often talking about AES digital, which is an audio only format. So,
yeah. So IP can either go through these, or it can just go over these devices.
This is the Wi-Fi links are consumer gear. So their quality is not always great, and I recommend if you have the budget to get a spare of each end, if you have the budget, and pre-program them. That way, when you're up there in the mountain, and you know, it's just bad, and they're cheap.
What are these devices called?
Okay, let's go through them. So this is a codec or an encoder, and we're also calling it a barracks, because that's a brand name that we use a lot. A codec is just a coder and a decoder. So decoder, jump word. And the brand name that we're talking about is a barracks. These things, you know, you might call them dishes, or you might call them radios, some people call them, or Wi-Fi, or you might also call them Ubiquiti, which is a brand name, or Microtech, which is another brand name. So so it's a four-part system, but fortunately all the parts are kind of cheap.
So they're Wi-Fi antennas?
Yeah, they're Wi-Fi antennas, and they work. They actually will work with your computer, too, kind of. And they sell things that do that. It's just that they're highly directional, and so they take all the energy. It's kind of the same thing as your home router that, you know, that does that, but instead of spreading it all over the house, it focuses it into a tiny beam, so that it can go, you know, 5 miles, 10 miles, whatever we need. And there are different models that are different distances that you can go. Mostly it's the dish size. Some have a dish that's like this big, and those can go like, I don't know, 5 miles, and then there's a dish that's big, and can go 20 miles, and so
the inexpensive unit come with the radio built into the dish itself, right? And dependably, you might get 5 or 10 miles out of that, but depending on the existing interference conditions and stuff like that. They have been known to go a lot further. You can buy a separate transmitter that plugs into the back of a bigger dish, which is still relatively inexpensive, but Ubiquiti makes that. How far was Spokane? You got 45 or 50 miles?
Yeah,
something like
43
that.
Miles. Yeah,
43 miles.
And yeah, that's fine.
How does it do across like vegetation or?
No, it's still got to be line of sight.
Got to be line of sight. Make your hole taller or make an intermediate site.
But you're out of the $300 range at that point, and you want to figure on spending how much is, what, you know.
Well, of the Ubiquities, the most you could spend is less than $2,000 for both ends.
Yeah.
Now that's for the high quality one that'll do 40 plus miles.
Other questions? Bye. Sorry to jump in.
No, thank you.
No, that's very good. Thank you.
Okay, no panic on the time yet. We're still fine. We've got too much time, so let us now proceed to the so you guys already talked about entangles. Did you have anything further to say than legal license? No? Okay.
We could talk all day, but we don't have all day.
Okay, Michael, let's talk about what about used equipment?
Okay. How can I get that one page? Okay. I'm just going to do it without the visual bit. Or I'll just bring up that page here.
Wow. Look who was prepared.
We've talked about this before, so I'll make it like in 3 minutes. New broadcast equipment in adjusted dollars is cheaper than ever. We've already talked about why you're probably going to have to buy a new transmitter. The EAS, we maybe didn't talk about it. The Common Alerting Protocol, CAP, is a relatively new requirement, basically internet access, another way of getting the alert information into your box. And all of the EAS boxes that are more than about 2 years old don't have that in there. And so you either have to buy a new box or buy a converter. The converters cost more than half as much as a whole new box. So, short story, you're buying a new box. The Sage boxes, which are what most people are getting, are only about $2,300, $2,400 street price now with all the latest whiz-bang stuff. So, and you've heard about the digital alert systems. They're a similar price range. Those are the two most common ones. You're going to have to buy that new. STL, if you want to get an old analog unidirectional composite STL, if you're processing at the studio, you can get those used sometimes less than $1,500. But you can buy a brand new IP system for less than that, so why bother? So what does this come down to? Some of your studio equipment you might get used. Your furniture, absolutely. Your desks, your chairs, your computers, all of those can be used or donated. But your core electronic broadcasting equipment, you're probably going to be buying new. It's just the way it's working out now.
One reason, Michael, is that if you buy used equipment, it's more likely to have a breakdown, and then you have to pay for an engineer to come fix it, and you're off the air for a while.
Yeah.
So think in the long term. I know it's hard when you're trying to raise money to think of in the long term, but it saves you money to go ahead and buy the new equipment.
And this is sort of off subject, but just briefly, I talked about, I guess we're not going to have a section on the self-extension checklist, but absolutely, this is absolute must reading.
Mm-hmm.
You can just Google FCC LPFM checklist. and you'll find this document. If the latest version is 2008, but go through that line by line. If you can get through it, you're legal. The inspectors themselves will often use this checklist or something close to it.
Yeah, I just wanted to double back on another thing. So, like, yeah. I'm a huge advocate for reusing computers, but
they're really cheap now.
They are really cheap now, and I built a lot of stations in Latin America where I couldn't just pop back in, you know, like when something went wrong. So, I mean, that taught us a lot regarding, you know, like donated computers. I mean, we would obviously wipe them clean. I would take out the hard drive, put in a new hard drive.
Uh-huh.
You know, all these different things, so many different things that can go wrong that eventually will go wrong. And just so, like, considering that you can get a nice desktop for $300 and with, you know, like all up-to-date, you know, software that's going to be reliable for X amount of time longer than, you know, something else someone gives you is, wow, this is a great Windows XP box that has like a sleeping virus on it, you know. The amount of headaches that, you know, like it can bring about are great versus how inexpensive it is, and then you're getting a totally fresh start. And I'm also a really big advocate for having specifically dedicated use computers.
Yes.
You know, so it's like this computer is running your automation software, and this other computer is running your production software, you know, and that's it. And, you know, like some other very particular kinds of things, so that it doesn't start to get bogged down with a variety of different issues. And so sometimes used equipment will already be, it may seem clean, like someone deleted everything, but it may be bogged down by whatever other things, so.
Yeah, I would agree. I would use, if you use those used computers, use them for non-mission critical.
If you're going to get a used computer, the first thing you do is you wipe it clean.
Yeah.
And the experience I have with them is to basically figure of whatever number of used computers you get donated, on the average, you'll get half of them working.
Yeah.
And what I really mean by that is that less than half of them work, but I take parts from this one and put them out.
Yeah, exactly.
Our total number of computers working, which is equal to half of the number we started with.
Elizabeth? I would just add, sometimes people, out of the goodness of their hearts, want to give you things, and then sometimes they're giving you headaches they don't intend.
Yes.
But if you're also if you're working with young people or other people who might want to have a job either in radio, there aren't any of those, but in other sort of technological fields, if you're training them on obsolete equipment, you're not doing them any good. And, you know, it's sort of like, I was talking about it today, it's like a colonial model where we hand me down. You've got to be careful of that, even when people's intentions are good.
Well, get everything new then. The old desk is good.
Having said that, there is some legacy equipment that is not made anymore, but it's worth buying.
Okay, so let's move on to the next segment, which is why audio processing matters.
Oh boy. Can somebody turn on those speakers and just flip on the on switches on the back of those two, both speakers? Okay, it will work, yes. Okay, what I did here, I've run across many times with people that don't know about compression and limiting and audio processing. Why do I need that? And if I do need that, why don't I just use a $100 compressor that I can get from Guitar Center, and that'll be enough. And there's a lot of reasons why that doesn't work. A lot of your listeners are going to be listening in a noisy environment like a car. So having a wide dynamic range just is not realistic for your radio broadcast in most cases. You need to have... Yes?
Can you
what does compression do?
It makes the differences between the soft passages and loud passages much less so, more even sound. But taken to its extreme, it sounds like crap. And so what I was going to do is play some samples of the same audio cut, unprocessed, processed with an Orban 8400, which is like a $12,000 near top of the line processor, using a mild setting, which I think sounds reasonably good. Then I'm going to give you two settings that will probably be typical of your local classic rock radio station. It's way over-processed, and it's just fatiguing as all get out. But the reason, some of the many reasons why you can't just use a $100 Guitar Center processor is FM radio has a pre-emphasis. The high frequencies are tremendously boosted, 16.7 decibels at 15 kilohertz. And then your receiver rolls that off, and it becomes relatively flat. But what happens is every time a cymbal is or an S comes out of your mouth, you've got this very sudden and very large peak of audio. And if you had nothing to compress and limit that down, you're basically limited to the very loudest instantaneous. And that brings up another point. FM broadcasting, any broadcasting, has a absolute maximum loudness that'll let you broadcast. And if you exceed that more than very occasionally, you are over-modulating, and it's a finable offense, and it can also, in extreme cases, cause interference. And so you've got to limit those occasional peaks, particularly that sibilance and the cymbals, and you've got to get a more consistent audio sound that can be listened to in a noisy car. And to some extent, if you have, most audio processors now take different bands, like the low bass, the mid-range, and the high frequencies, and separately compress them to give a little bit of adjustment, sort of a smart graphic equalizer, if you will, without going too far, to kind of even out the sound so that your oldies don't sound really dull and your dance music doesn't sound horribly bright. They sound more even. So it's more consistent sound. So with that in mind, I'm going to play a little bit of an unprocessed audio. And if you can see this is the old Adobe Audition. You can see that most of the sound is pretty quiet here, and you get this occasional peak. You're going to say, when I play these four cuts, well, all you're doing is turning up the volume. No. All four of these cuts are set at the same peak level, but with various levels of processing. So this first one is this audio cut, totally unprocessed and normalized so that the highest peak is right at 100%. So, that sounds fine. Okay, now I'm going to switch to the processed one. Mildly processed. Why don't we start over? I'm going to start over with this. So here's the difference between unprocessed and lightly processed. Already you can see it's several dB louder. Now you want to get crazy. Probably how your local rock station sounds. Or if you want to go even crazier, this is a preset, a standard preset.
Turn down the light.
Not too good.
Turn down the bed.
I'd much rather listen to this.
Inside my head.
Okay, now taking it to an extreme. Listenable, because they do some amazing things in DSP to try to minimize the artifacts. But still, if nothing else, digital signal processing. If nothing else, it's just plain fatiguing. And these rock stations are not looking at you listening for hours. They just want you for the next 10 minutes. And so what we suggest is you consider if spending the money on proper audio processing, but don't go crazy with it. And these two transmitters that we talked about both have pretty good processors built right in, but you can get external ones if you want, but you just cannot get by with the $100 Guitar Center version. And if you do, you're either going to be very dull sounding, or you're going to disappear on the dial, or if you try pushing it, you're just going to sound distorted and not very loud. You don't want to be the loudest thing on the dial. Because the loudest thing on the dial in most markets is just, to me, is unlistenable.
The
Orban.
So the Orban is closer to the better sound, or
it'll do all of these sounds.
Actually, all these are through an Orban, but this one, this third one, was actually one of their presets, but it was a loud compressed preset, and a lot of rock stations are using it, but I wouldn't recommend that. But the Orban version that's built into the Nautel is kind of a step down from this, but still is perfectly a wonderful sounding. And the processor in the BW is a little bit more rudimentary than that, but it actually is perfectly acceptable and clean sounding in most stations. So you can spend months fine tweaking these things. But most of these processors come with a number of presets built in. So I would suggest trying those presets, and then you can fine-tune it if you're really ambitious after that. But any questions?
I've got a question.
Yeah.
I don't know if this got to an earlier topic, but are boards something that y'all feel are worth looking at the used market? What's the consensus there?
Well, me.
Sometimes they're great. I mean, and they were built to last through a nuclear holocaust. I mean, depending on the brand and whatever, they can be trouble to get connectors for, and they can be complicated to work on. But sometimes if you take like a 30-year-old board or 20-year-old board, it would actually last longer than a new cheap Chinese board, you know, that put in. So they were just built to be very resilient. Boards is one of those places where I sometimes use it.
I need to put in a plug for my thing, but actually, the answer for used board depends on what you're getting. And if your used board has surface mount components, no. If your used board is all through hole mounted, it has Penny and Giles faders, yes. And plan on replacing all the electrolytic capacitors.
Penny and Giles, the sliders.
The sliders, yeah. Yes. And if you're going to go use, the Penny, the faders, the slide faders. Okay, the ones that I'm using standard cost me about $5 a piece. And if the manufacturer wants Penny and Giles faders, the cost in quantity for a manufacturer is about $60 or $70, and figure add $100 per fader to the price of a board. And so if you're going to get something used and it has these very nice Penny and Giles faders, you might want to go for it. But I wouldn't. I think that would be the threshold for a used one. Is that I probably an old, if you have a used board that has surface mount components and the cheaper faders, I wouldn't.
Okay. And also, if you have somebody around who likes to learn how to work on things like that, that's going to, because if you're not that way inclined and you have to hire it out, it's like,
Right. No.
But anyway,
exactly.
I need to put in a plug for my product since you asked.
I wouldn't pay much for one. I would just ask around,
right.
Like local engineers, and there you will find local engineers at radio stations that are crying because they took out this board that they consider to be perfectly good.
It's in the back room just in case something really horrible happens.
Yeah, and someone's been yelling at them to get rid of it for 10 years now, and you could fly an airplane with it.
But the key is those kind of Giles faders.
If you want a large board, which actually some community stations need, especially if you've got turntables back here, with consolidation, a lot of these stations moved together. And the old studios, they took out boards that sometimes were only 5 years old, and they're sitting in the back room. There's still some of those available. So, but you got to be careful and have somebody on staff who likes working with them.
Let's move on to the illustrated installation. Just to give you a visual of some of the things that the guys were trying to do.
You wanted these pictures?
Yeah, they should be.
Oh. Well, this is an example of a medium-sized board. It's really ironic that the average commercial station today only needs a tiny board because everything's coming off the computer. Community radio, you're still bringing in CDs, you're still bringing in vinyl, you might even be bringing in a cassette or two, you're going to bring in your laptop, your iPod, frankly, it'd be nice to have a console that's big enough for all that. And so here you are, this control room, we built this in near Redding, California. We've got 14 channels here, I think. And we could have used more. We've got 14 channels and two 8 select multi-selectors that are all filled. This is a high school station in Portland. It's running mostly on computer. This is another view of that first, no it isn't, no, what is this? No, this is a classical station in Portland with about a 20-channel board.
And they've got, what's the library? That's only a small portion of their library.
They actually recently moved, and they're now all off hard disk, 100%. Uh-huh. And using a smaller console. That console may be available for us to pick up. I'll go talk with them. No, see, I'm absolutely serious.
Can you zoom in on the sliders, though?
In a closet. Who wants it?
I want it.
Who wants it? That's 20.
We have to open it up and
right.
Underneath.
It's a beautiful console.
See the manufacturer name on each side.
Okay, here's the other view of the one that Betty and I built in Redding area. And once again, I talked about two turntables, two computers, one with dual monitors, three CD players, one of which will record CD. We even have a flash recorder and player, and we have a dual cassette player and a digital delay, all in that side pot, and some reasonably nice speakers for microphone locations.
Is that a
how much, Mike?
Room? Yeah, it's a corner pod.
How much was that?
How much was the whole?
This is that studio.
How much is that?
Oh,
studio
oh gosh.
The so
they had a PTFP. I think the console with the wiring harnesses was about $8,000. Those are the Stanton turntables I might have mentioned briefly. These are the two Denon CDs that are about $500 a piece now, something like that. Gosh, I don't know. $30,000 in this room? $25,000?
$30,000?
The studio furniture is. Is kind of off-the-shelf, semi-custom. I think we spent $5,000 on the studio furniture. It was shipped, knocked down, and kit put together.
Was that for both studios?
Per studio, $5,000 per room. Yeah. These are, those are RE20 microphones, which are by on the street price about $350 a piece. But we mated them with the SM58, the $100 microphones that were mentioned
which
earlier.
Which also doubled as hammers.
They sound almost the same. The RE20s are a little bit nicer, but they're not 3.5 times nicer.
Right.
You know, what we use the RE20 for the main announcer and the sidekick, and then everybody else gets the SM58.
Some of the things that we've been pulling together in the assessments we've been doing with is the equipment listing, which a fair amount of this gear, to like do bulk purchasing for all of it together is some of the stuff that Prometheus is also pulling together. So if you guys are interested.
Any more information on the last segment today?
Yeah. This is the production room that mated with that little... that control room, and we used just a smaller version of the same console, which people really appreciated because it was all the same equipment. They didn't have to when you can do that, buy the same console for your second studio.
Because you can train in there.
And your third studio probably can just be a workstation on a computer, It doesn't need much of a mixer or maybe not even a mixer at all.
You want to take a picture? Or?
Yeah, I do.
I can send you the...
All right.
Okay, well, yeah. You go ahead if you want.
No,
so this is a small production room, and by the way, at a touch of a button, this room can go on the air. It's a second studio. We had a cross point switcher, and actually, I think you have to step outside of the room and push a button, and then you can put this room on the air. We had the automation was mirrored, so you could run the automation from either room. So that was handy. Mm-hmm. This is a little station. Tom's not here, is he?
He has to go.
In 3 days, we put together a little studio in Vieques, our initial studio. You can't see it, but the speakers are sitting on a cardboard box. Now, this is a little console that I particularly like for small LPFM stations. It's the Wheatstone Audio Arts Air 1. It's 8 channels, no AV switches, no remote selectors. We added a remote selector up here somewhere, which isn't wired in yet. We did buy one of those dual Stanton CD players where if something goes out, they both go out. but it works. It's been on the air, and they've had no failures since then. Yeah.
We got that for internet radio stations.
$1,600, and it has, and it actually has one built-in sound card, USB input. So
it's great. It's so easy too. It's a very low
easy
learning curve.
What's that model number?
It's the Air 1, the Audio Arts Wheatstone Audio Arts Air 1. It's about $1,600. We think that this is the perfect starter console for an LPFM, unless you get his comp, which
it wasn't available.
Yeah, but it's but like I said, it's only 8 channels. It's not expandable. No AV switches. No line selectors. So you gotta have to carefully choose how many inputs you have. This is the totality of the equipment rack in Puerto Rico. With a Sage EAS box. This actually is a preprocessor that we put ahead of the Barracks boxes. Actually, is that a Barracks? There? It might be somewhere in there. We actually did what Tom said don't do, and we bought some eBay tuners to feed the input of our EAS for $30 a piece. And it worked. Well, some of the tuners we got on eBay, and then we actually got this from the defunct Hawaii station that sold off. Yeah, we ended up with their...
A little bit about the consumer tuners.
Yeah.
The best ones are the car radios.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
so you get a car radio, and of course, you're going to have to set up a 12-volt supply to run it, but...
They do work, yeah.
But they do work. They have the 50-ohm input, and if you can keep the power on... have to keep some kind of power backup so that it doesn't lose its settings.
Yes.
Or get one with knobs.
Yes. So what I've done a lot of this.
Yeah,
I buy $30 tuners on eBay, and most of them will hold the station if they lose power. Some of them do not. But at $30 a piece, it's kind of a low risk. So actually, one of these is an NAD, a pretty high-end tuner in its day. And one of these, I think, was our EES, and the other one is our off-air monitor. And we're perfectly happy with it. And this is our network switch at this end. I guess we're jumping back to Reading. Okay, so why don't we go to transmitter sites? Well, this is that same rooftop antenna. While it was being constructed with the stand we talked about. It's actually a translator. And me hanging on for dear life on the tower. This is a one we recently did at the last minute. Tom did this, put an antenna below somebody else's. This is in Sun Valley, Ketchum, Idaho.
Why does that other one look so funny, Michael?
This one here?
Yeah.
That one, that's a Shively with a radome on it. We went with a double V without a radome. And actually, they have that covers, keeps the snow and ice off. This particular brand of antenna has to have a radome or it just won't work with the slightest amount of frost. This can withstand a light frosting and doesn't need it, so that's what we did. And this is it's a 100-watt full power station in Sun Valley. And there's Tom on top of a cherry picker. putting it in. In January, I think it was. It was cold. What is this? Oh, this is the low power FM in Spokane years ago with a 2-bay ring stub. They've since taken those down and gone full power.
Was that their old STL there?
Yeah, that was. We actually had a 2-hop. This is a conventional 950 megahertz license, unidirectional,
analog.
Old school STL.
Nobody in here should be using one of those.
Well, you can, but I don't recommend it. So yeah, here's a nice close up of the base of that tower. I think in this case we had about 1,200 pounds of blocks there, and the roof. We ran the I mean, it's putting less stress per square foot than a human standing on the roof, even with all that. We're jumping all around here. This is back in Puerto Rico. Tom's there. This was the midpoint of our 2-hop STL using those IP microwaves. So this actually is, this is what I recommend actually for short hops. It's called, what is it called? Anyway. Yeah, it's Ubiquity, but it has a certain name. Anyway, this is the $250. No, the rocket is this. This is the one I recommend for short range, and it's actually a dish inside a big flat panel, and we use that for the first hop, which was only like a half a mile, and then this 3.5-foot dish goes the final 13 miles across the water to the other island. So. Tom custom built this stand on top of an apartment building. This is kind of just a typical rack installation of a low power FM with STL and a little 150 watt transmitter, I think it is.
And do you recommend spacing them that way?
We had a big rack and lots of space, so it was it cooled it better. If you got the space, just spread them out. Some things, if you put them right on top of each other, the heat is just too much. I think it's best actually to leave one rack space between things. Anything that will generate heat.
That's just 1 5/8.
Yeah,
some of them that advertise, yeah. This thing fits in a 2-unit rack space.
Yeah.
If you read the fine print, it says to leave another 2 units airspace around it.
Yeah,
for the fan, yeah.
If it's too hot to touch, it's definitely too hot. Yeah.
So this is an example of a volunteer build. Chuck is so hard to manipulate.
But this is the Puerto Rico one's a full power station. That's a 4-kilowatt station. So, but you know, a lot of the same things. We basically built an FM, an LPFM grade studio with a full power station, but. Most of the same things apply.
We have lots of stories we can regale you with about this build. It's not like that. If you're interested.
Okay. I think that's all the pictures we have.
It is all the pictures, but this is supposed to be the entree into can you use volunteers to do your build?
Oh.
I think that answers that. Okay, so that's me and Alan. I just, one thing I like.
Yeah, I'm just going to say yes to everything.
Okay. I'll be yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Excuse me, go ahead.
So, I don't know, one way I like to frame this, think about the worst jobs there are in the United States.
Pig farmer.
Farming, yeah. Yeah, you know. We've worked a lot with farm workers. And, you know, people like at the Coalition of the Monthly Workers that have been working with the slave-like conditions of farm workers in the United States. Long hours, no rights, no control, you know, all that sort of thing. So it's definitely one of the worst occupations you could have in the United States being a farm worker. Think about what one of the biggest hobbies is in the United States. Things that people do as volunteers for free, for fun.
Oh, it's not NASCAR?
Gardening. Yeah. So, what's the difference between being a farm worker and a gardener?
Choice.
One belongs to you, the other doesn't.
Yeah, one belongs to you. You're doing the same thing. I mean, you're growing watermelons, or whatever, or you're growing carrots, but it's your ability to make decisions about it.
Yeah.
whether you control the output of your labor, whether you actually benefit by it, whether you're able to organize it and choose who you're doing it with, and the people that you're, you know, whether you can just walk away when you're done or whether you have to just keep on working for 12 more hours. And so when I think about what work needs to get paid at a radio station, at a community radio station, I often use that as a framework. Because, as I said before, when most people think about who needs to get paid at the radio station, they're thinking of a commercial radio station. So they're thinking about, you know, Howard Stern's $5 million contract or whatever it is, you know, $20 million contract. At a community radio station, most people are doing it for fun. They're doing it to make friends. They're doing it to inform their communities. They're doing it, you know, to become micro-famous for, you know, 5 miles around the transmitter site. They're doing it to share a kind of music or something that they don't think would get there otherwise, that other people would have an opportunity to hear. So when you're thinking about your resources to build this station, you know, one of your biggest resources is things that people consider to be fun. And it may really surprise you what people do think is fun. Like, you know, you may very well find a person that thinks that this presentation, like everything we're talking about today, fun. More fun than, like, they could possibly have any other way. Other people are, like, snoring. They're like, oh, my God, I can't believe, you know. So, you know, it all depends on the volunteers that you attract. What is the paid work and what is the fun work? Yeah, but you can't kind of make it into fun if that's not what, you know, what the people you find, you know, think of that way.
So one of the things that, you know, like that we like to think about, or like I like to think about in this, is what is it that would make something not fun for someone? So like if there's like this initial excitement, you get, you know, like some volunteers, you know, like that are, oh, I would love to be a part of this. It's coming up. They're starting to see it happening, developing. But you know that excitement may very well wither away depending on the type of experience that they got plugging in. So you want to think about, like, how do you keep this as like a gardening project and not, you know, like working in, you know, like in fields under harsh conditions. So one of the key things that we, you know, that I think about is like disappointment. You know, disappointment not just in the progress of what's happening, but disappointment in your own expectations of what you expected, you know, what you mean to get out of this experience, or even how much a sense of agency you have in the project, right? So having things very transparent in a way, you know, like that this is what this volunteer role is what these are the expectations. This is what we need. This is, you know, and then having it as articulated as best as possible ahead of time leaves little room for surprises, which can, you know, like then lead to that disappointment and then resentment, and you start to have people pulling away. Or or you have people that may look at something and it's this ambiguous title, you know, like we need a resources department, you know, and it can mean so many different things. And people are like, oh, sure, I want to be a part of that. And then it ultimately means that, you know, you're like, you know, throwing fundraiser dinners or something, you know. And some people might love that and some people won't. So having things that are clearly defined so that when people self-define, like, where their interest is, they're plugging in very clear places, as well as gives you the opportunity to, like, know what to look for when you got new volunteers that come at the door and you're like, oh, this person's history is that they used to do a lot of public speaking. You know, oh, this would be a great person for outreach. You know, like having these kinds of roles very, very clearly articulated. And then you see that people start to feel both included, valued for what their contributions are, as well as you start filling in some of those holes that, you know, that inadvertently a lot of the people in this room, I'm sure, are kind of like part of the core group that's making these things happen. And you could be one of three people that keep switching hats, you know, taking lead in the project, that you could start to actually focus on the larger aspects of it and leaving room for other people to step in and be able to do it while being guided and provided the type of support that's going to be needed for that particular role.
Well, some of the things, I know I'm not on the list to speak, but I was recalling some of the situations that came up when we were doing the build in Puerto Rico. The tower that we wanted to be on belongs to Crown Castle, which can be a very stubborn company to try to deal with. And they said, absolutely not, your volunteers cannot climb this tower and put up your antenna. And so that was a problem because they wanted to have their own people do it for an additional, what was it, $15,000?
Yeah, at least, yeah.
Yeah, and so we didn't have that money right that moment. So what can we do? Well, it turned out that one of the supporters knew a guy who works for Crown Castle as a tower climber. And he turned out to be a fabulous guy helping us out. And his brother-in-law, he came along as the assistant. Apparently, it was okay for an employee to bring an assistant. And so that was one. We were lucky to get around that one. And I should have put that picture in there. So sometimes you just really have to think on your feet about how am I going to get around this thing that's going to cost me $15,000.
The most important thing is start early.
Yeah.
The actual construction may only span several weeks or 2 or 3 months, but the planning can easily take 6 to 18 months. And if you've got to deal with local zoning, it could take longer than that. So,
yeah.
Are you having trouble with local zoning stuff?
No, because everybody ignores it. Nobody files for permits.
Yeah. Is it dangerous to ignore it? Because that's one thing I haven't been clear on. Like, what happens if you ignore it and somebody gets mad at you and finds out you didn't get a permit?
That doesn't happen
where
you live.
No, not
when they live. If you're in Texas, you're safe. If you're in New York, probably not.
Not
really. You're not going to
be here.
No. Where's that? And just one thing to like, one thing to keep in mind is that being community radio stations, the draw that you've been on, being community radio stations, the role for volunteers is going to be constant. So having stability around how to orient, you know, properly, how to support, how to like have a process in place that can make people feel both welcome, useful, and enriched by the experience is an absolute critical part, well beyond the building of it. I mean, the building's just the start. You know, that's just the beginning of it for the sustainability of the station and its ongoing you know, kind of like growth and development, especially if you're going to have like volunteers. Even if you have, if you're, you know, able to guarantee some paid staff, I mean, you know, that's not going to be enough for like having a robust community radio station. You're going to be wanting to pull in from the community in a variety of different ways. So like, but having that process, having those things very well, very clear, and even to various degrees, publicized a little bit, you know, like, exactly, this is what we're looking for. You could even put out job descriptions of what you're looking for as volunteer job descriptions, you know, like are well articulated, and maybe even stretch out your reach where you could find a tower climber, or you could find, you know, like that local engineer who's like, yeah, I'm retiring next week. I would love to, you know, come spend time doing this over there.
Okay, number one mistake that stations do with new volunteers: invite them to a meeting. How awful. Do you think, like, when people walk into a megachurch for the first time, they get invited to a meeting? No. They get taken around, they get introduced to people, they meet a bunch of people, they see the friendliest side of that place. You know, they do not come to a meeting where everyone's arguing about the budget and like how to make expenditures of over $25 and like, you know, like all that kind of thing. So really, like, you know, like a good orientation process where people see like your bad parts, your annoying and boring parts last rather than first is really, really, really kind of tough.
The worst thing you can do to volunteer is micromanage.
Mm-hmm. Give a job and don't tell exactly.
Well, no, not exactly. Sometimes it depends on the situation. But micromanagement in the sense of having a paid staff whose basic purpose is to be a surveillance, to do surveillance over the volunteers.
So two of the ladies in the room are doing a volunteer workshop tomorrow, Elizabeth and Bear.
3:45.
Yeah, 3:45 tomorrow, volunteers and volunteer people, right?
Here's our volunteer. Here's our volunteer in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, well, he was pretty mad about us being here.
In terms of volunteers, I mean, one thing that NEWA has finally done after 27 years to existence is institute training programs for new programmers. And in behind that, came 27 years, finally doing it right. And they also understand that if they're going to get on the air, there's an expectation of volunteers. There's never a part of NEWA's culture. It's not like, some people think we should say, oh, yeah, you have to do this. But no, we don't want people to have to volunteer. And when you say slavery was done away with, we want people to do stuff because they love to do it. And so, I think that's part of it, is bringing people into the station, having them do something that really excites them, learning to engineer, learning to how to put together a program, how to be a community journalist, and then also how much fun it is to work with Budge Drive. The other thing I'll say in terms of Prometheus, I went to a barn raising in Woodburg. I don't know how many years ago now, 5, 6, 7 years ago, John Foss. My nephew, who was in his early 20s, came with me. And to this day, he's 28, 29 now, he'll say that was the best time I've ever had. He was like completely blown away. And as soon as he walked in, he started volunteering and started stuffing envelopes into things, and then he was showing people how to solder stuff, and he's doing this and doing that. And I think, turning young people on to that stuff. And I don't know when Prometheus has a barn raising, or whether anyone else wants to organize one in terms of getting your station up on the air, but it is an awesome way to improve your community and bring all kinds of amazing energy.
To piggyback on what you were saying, we, in Santa Fe, we've got Youth Media Project, which is internationally renowned. And Youth Media Project is housed in Warehouse 21, where KGCR is. And I used to be Director of Education and Training for YMC, and what's really nice about that is that you've got young people that are learning how to produce, learning how to create content, learning how to interview, and you've got free content coming in that you can air. The other thing we have that is also worth exploring is other businesses within the community. We're working with Hutton Broadcasting, which is a commercial radio broadcasting entity, but they're providing 4 interns. So they're training interns at Hutton to work at Warehouse 21 with KGZR. So it's kind of like, good, we don't have to pay you, Hutton's paying you, and these young, it's all guys, and we need to change that. But these 4 young cats are learning all the ropes, and then they can then come in and spread the wealth around. It's a great way to also just connect with those in the community who are willing to provide that kind of experience.
Can I add one more thing, or one more element? I guess the first time Pete ever asked me to participate in a workshop was the first round of LPFM station, where we all are now. And he said to me, everybody's just totally clutched about technology, and they're clueless about the human problems that you have. And so I did a workshop with him covering those things. But we all know, those of us who've been at stations anywhere know that one person that's out of control can mess up the whole thing. So I think it's really important. And the other thing that in terms of the volunteers, and I don't know if it's true, but the communities that we come from, one of the ones that I'm working on right now, everybody that uses the center knows how to do all kinds of things because they don't have any expendable income to build things. So, you know, they'll be happy to do carpentry, to do painting, to do wiring and things like that if you know what it is you need them to do.
Well, it's break time, if that's okay with everyone. I'm not going to tell you about my computer system. It's 4:48, so let's come back again at 5:17. No.
5:03.
Thank you. 5:03. Thank you, Matt. 5:03.